Shrink Wrap Radio number 518, Understanding Addiction as a Developmental Disorder, with Maya Solovitz.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
Today, my guest is Maya Solovitz, journalist, former addict, and author of the 2016 book Unbroken Brain, A Revolutionary New Way of Understanding Addiction. For more information about Maya Solovitz, please see our show notes on shrinkwrapradio.com. Before we go to the interview, let me mention that this week's featured article in the Neuropsychotherapist is PTSD or ADHD, Managing Difficult Distinctions and Comorbidities. You'll find it at neuropsychotherapist.com, which is the beautifully illustrated online monthly magazine for psychotherapists and anyone else interested in the intersection between the latest neuroscience findings and psychotherapy. I want you to go to neuropsychotherapist.com and get your free introductory issue today. And I'm hoping that will inspire you to support their superlative work by subscribing to it. Today's show is also brought to you by Bombas.com. Save 20% off your first order at www.getbombas.com/shrinkwrapradio. Now, here's the interview. Maya Solovitz, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. I think I first heard about your book. I just caught sort of a part of the interview with Terry Gross of Fresh Air NPR. And of course, she's one of my idols as an interviewer. But it's really great to be picking up her crumbs, which sometimes I've been able to do. So I'm really happy that you accepted my invitation so readily.
Sure.
And we're going to be discussing your remarkable book, which is titled Unbroken Brain, A Revolutionary New Way of Understanding Addiction. So, you know, you're not a psychologist or a psychiatrist. You're a career journalist, a very successful one. So just as some people might wonder, well, what does this woman know about addiction?
Sure.
Well, in fact, you got an award from the APA for your work in addiction. So why should we credit what you have to say about addiction? And I mean that in the friendliest possible way.
No, absolutely. This is a kind of funny and ironic question for me, because I could just say, well, I'm a person who had an addiction, so therefore I'm an expert. But that is actually not what I believe.
Uh-huh.
The real reason you should trust me on this issue is because I have been studying it, interviewing experts, writing about addiction, reading about addiction, fighting about addiction, and thinking about addiction for probably around 30 years now. And so I have spoken with pretty much a large proportion of the leading experts in the area, and I am respected by the experts in the area as somebody who knows this subject quite well. I should have gotten around to getting a PhD, but I did not.
Yeah, I think so. In fact, I was so impressed as I was going through the book, and it's hard to believe that you're not a person with a PhD, because just in the writing of this book and everything that's gone into it, I would say, here's a fantastic doctoral dissertation.
If you go to the UK, you can actually do that and write a book and get a PhD just based on a dissertation, but somehow, even though I've written 7 books, I've never managed to actually do this, but maybe one day.
Yeah, geez, I've never even heard that before. That's interesting. Now, the subtitle of your book is A Revolutionary New Way of Understanding Addiction. And I have to say, it certainly, as I was reading it, it struck me as new and revolutionary, especially in as much as you assert that drug addiction is a developmental condition that most people will grow out of. And you give some remarkable statistics on that. Do you remember any of those stats top of your head?
Absolutely. No, it is basically about 50% of people who have addictions, with the exception of nicotine, will grow out of them by age 30. Alcohol is a teeny bit later, so it's 35, but a remarkable proportion of people who you can't tell which one is like falling off drunk on the bar stool, you will not be able to tell which one of those people will age out or not, but half of them will.
Uh-huh. Wow. Interesting that nicotine is the exception. I just paused for a moment there. As a psychologist, I worked with people trying to quit smoking, and it was incredibly hard. It's the only drug that people need to dose themselves with, what, every 20 minutes or something like that.
One of the things that's odd about addiction is that the shorter the time between doses, the more intense the addiction. But I think one of the things with cigarettes that really makes it almost so much more difficult to quit is that you can do it all day and it's not impairing your performance. In fact, it may be performance enhancing in some cases.
Yeah.
And you're not experiencing the negative consequences until very much later. I mean, you'll experience shortness of breath or, you know, smelly clothes and this kind of thing very early on. But you will not experience lung cancer or any of the really dire outcomes very early. And so that makes it particularly insidious and long-lasting.
Yeah, and we know that human beings are not very good at changing their behavior based on long-term consequences that are far out.
No, and I mean, that actually has to do with the way our dopamine circuits are wired, which discounts further out pleasure at a steeper rate than if it's immediate pleasure. And that makes sense if you are a creature faced with predators and other things. If you have, say, a reproductive opportunity, you should take it.
Yeah.
But it does not work to our advantage when things involve long-term planning.
Okay. And so this developmental view, for example, you say that people who pick up an addictive substance in their middle to late 20s are much more likely to be able to quit at some point and maybe to say, I could take it or leave it.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's really interesting about addictions is there is a really strong period of high developmental risk, which coincides with the adolescent period in life. And during that time, there's three times when brain development is particularly intense. The first is prenatal, the second is the first 5 years, and the third is adolescence into young adulthood. And during that time, what's going on is the motivational areas that are there biologically to power, you know, reproductive and survival success are developing, but the parts that control those, the parts that put the brakes on those engines, are not developing until the mid to late 20s, or are not fully developed. They're developing during this period, but they are not as strong as they might be until later. And so basically during your teens, as everybody who's met a teen or been a teen knows, you're going to do some crazy stuff.
Yeah, yeah. So you describe addiction as a developmental learning disorder, and we'll get into the learning part of it, the developmental part of it. And so my initial reaction was, oh, great excitement. You can say it in one sentence, and that sounds like a nice, neat little package. But as I got into the book, what became clear is that it's a very, very complex issue, and you end up going into a lot of those complexities so that there are all sorts of issues, and we'll be exploring them. Now, I'd like to go into your story a bit of your own addiction, and you've managed it masterfully in the book, sort of telling your story gradually as one moves through the book and mixing that in with a lot of the science you know, and what we know about addiction and the different stages of life and the brain processes and so on. So let's start out. I don't know if we should tell your whole story right now or let's get started with it at least. I think you get started somewhere in your early teens.
In terms of the actual drug use. Yes.
Yeah, in terms using what, marijuana and psychedelics?
Yes.
Yeah. So tell us a bit about that phase of your life.
So I think I need to start a little earlier.
Okay.
What the reason I ended up smoking pot and taking a lot of acid and mushrooms and stuff like that is because I was always a very oversensitive outsider kind of kid. Since the earliest part of my life, I got bullied. I was unable to fit in very well with other kids at all. And I think today, if I were growing up, I probably would have been diagnosed with Asperger's or some form of autism spectrum disorder because I had sensory issues. I had social issues. I learned to read when I was 3, and I was very obsessive about a lot of different things. So I was the kind of kid who just went through these intense obsessive phases. And I kind of ignored other kids because either they were going to be mean to me or they just didn't share my interests at all. Or I would lecture them. So that wasn't very successful either. So I was an outcast, basically, by the time I got to 7th and 8th grade. And it was at that point that I realized, oh my gosh, I don't know how to do this social thing at all. I am, you know, just left out of this. I feel very lonely. I would love to connect, but I'm so weird, I don't think that will ever happen. And so I had, like, drug education at this point, and they're telling me, peer pressure is going to make you do drugs, but, you know, just say no. And I thought, aha, if peer pressure is going to make me do drugs, drugs must be a thing I can do to be cool. And so
yeah.
This was not your best drug education. But I decided that cigarettes were too dangerous. Alcohol, you lost motor control, which didn't sound good to me. But marijuana sounded interesting. But at that point, I was so uncool that there was nobody to peer pressure me into doing it. So it took me until I was in high school to actually find people to smoke pot with. So I was not the peer pressure case. I was the person who was looking to find the drugs. And I did. I got very into marijuana, and it was always my goal. I had read the electroquilate acid test, and I thought that this sounded like a way of, you know, connecting with the universe and
sort
of something social. Yeah. And indeed it was. If I had stuck to the psychedelics, I probably would have had a very different career and a very different life. But unfortunately, it was the 1980s, and when I was 17, I moved on to coke, and I was sort of involved with the Grateful Dead scene. My boyfriend was one of Jerry's dealers, and so it kind of went from there.
Yeah, in the book you describe sitting on a bed with Jerry Garcia of the Grateful Dead, and
yes.
You're doing drugs together, rolling joints and getting into cocaine and so on. So,
it was like, obviously this was not a good thing for him to have done, but he is still my musical hero. And it was, you know, obviously a very intense experience for somebody who was 17. But I have to say, he was only interested in the drugs. Nothing else happened.
Okay. For better or for worse.
Exactly. So, yeah. It was an experience, and it ended up being part of my story.
Yeah. Now, this raises a lot of issues that I'd like to get into. Another thing that I heard in the story of your own addiction was the impact of bullying on you. And that's something that you write about, just not in terms of yourself, but in terms of that age range and school experience generally. So tell us a bit about bullying.
Sure. I mean, there's some research that suggests that bullying can be as traumatic as being abused by your parents. Obviously, that's not always the case, but in some circumstances, it seems to be just as bad. And if you think about it from an evolutionary perspective, being rejected by your peer group is just about the worst thing that can happen to somebody, because we require our peers to survive as humans. So it's an extremely stressful situation. And one of the things that bullying actually does is it's a way to enforce status hierarchies on people. And it causes a stress response that makes the people lower on the hierarchy more susceptible to all kinds of problems, from mental illnesses and addictions to, even things like heart disease and diabetes.
Yeah, and one of the things that stood out for me about the status hierarchy thing that was really striking was you cited research that kids who rank high in popularity in school, say in junior high and high school, they don't have more friends. It just means they rate higher on dominance. Do I remember that correctly? That's kind of a surprising finding.
Fascinating, because if you ask, this is how they surveyed that. So if you ask the kids, who do they like most and who would they most want to hang out with, that answer is going to be different than you ask who are the popular kids. Because the popular kids are the ones who everybody looking at the school can say, these five kids are at the top of the social hierarchy. And these are the cool kids. These are the kids everyone looks up to. These are the kids that everybody's scared of. But they're not necessarily the kids that the other kids most want to hang out with. There will be some amazing people who will be able to be both popular and dominant. And they tend to be people who can afford to be kind. But oftentimes it is not the same people. Also, the difference between social success in junior high and high school is huge. The people who are socially dominant and at the top rank in junior high tend not to be so in high school, though obviously there are some exceptions. But in junior high, it's still sort of more crude and physical and about sort of enforcing things in a very mean girl's way. And that's less so, though obviously not entirely, in high school. In high school, you really get more sophisticated forms of social status issues.
Yeah, wow. Well, let's move your own story along a bit further, because when you were in high school and junior high, you had had some drug education and you'd made a pact with yourself, no powders. Marijuana's okay, psychedelics are okay, but no powders. And then somehow you end up breaking that rule. And it's not somehow. I think it's really because you were so insecure, as you described previously, and you were in love with a fellow who was into the hard stuff.
Yes. And one of the things that's very difficult to understand now about the 80s is that cocaine was just ubiquitous. I mean, it was all over popular culture. People did not believe it was addictive because it doesn't cause physical dependence, i.e. you don't get sick when you quit the way you do when you quit opioids.
Yeah, cocaine you're talking about now.
Yes, and so people thought, it's just like, they told us all this nonsense about marijuana, cocaine is just as harmless, and, obviously that proved not to be the case.
Yeah, I remember that. I bought into that and certainly experimented with cocaine, but just very occasionally, and only a few times.
But that's actually what happened for most people. Mm-hmm. Like most people, and this is true with heroin as well, even, if you try these drugs, only 10 to 15 to 20% at most become addicted.
And I was an adult already, so my identity was formed, and I had a job and family, I didn't have a whole bunch of those risk factors that adolescents have.
Yeah, and that's a very important point. Cocaine was just all over the place in the 80s, and we thought about it in a very different way. And I mean, that unfortunate way of thinking about addiction is physical dependence is a real problem now, because when we try to deal with the opioid situation, we end up with people thinking that, if you just deal with the physical dependence, then everything will be fine. But the physical dependence is not the important part. The important part in addiction is the compulsion and the craving and the desire to use long after you're feeling fine and not at all physically ill. So it makes people think incorrectly about it, and it causes all kinds of problems for maintenance treatments, because with maintenance treatments you will have the physical dependence, you will just not have the addiction.
So you make a distinction between physical dependence and psychological dependence, and you say that of the two, the psychological dependence is the much more challenging one to deal with.
Yeah, I don't even call it psychological dependence, because I think dependence is a misleading term. They took it out of the DSM with good reason, because you can be physically dependent. We're all physically dependent on air and water and food. This does not make us addicted to air, water, and food. Some of us are physically dependent on, you know, say an antidepressant, because if we stop taking that antidepressant, we may get depressed again. But does that mean I'm sitting around like craving Wellbutrin? That is not the case. Does that mean that I am using Wellbutrin despite negative consequences? No, the consequences are positive. So when you realize that addiction is compulsive behavior despite negative consequences, the dependence bit is just much less important. And, you know, America as a society stigmatizes dependence. We like to believe we're independent, but humans are inherently interdependent. And so if we think that dependence itself is bad, that leads to stupid concepts like codependence, where, you know, a woman who's like trying to care for her partner suddenly has a disease because she protects him when he's been drinking and his boss is on the phone. Like, that may be a misguided way to help the dude, but it is not a disease.
Right. So the disease model doesn't fit, and psychological. If I don't use the word dependence and I say, physical addiction and psychological addiction?
No, because the problem there is you get into the mind-body problem, because psychological addiction has to be physical ultimately too, unless we want to get into a discussion of the soul.
Okay.
So I just call it addiction and dependence. And dependence is often not a problem at all. There's lots of people dependent on blood pressure medication, on medications for other conditions, on insulin for diabetes. As long as you have a clean, safe, affordable supply, dependence is not a problem. Addiction, on the other hand, is a serious problem.
Yes. Okay. So moving your story along, you did get involved with powders and in a fairly extreme way of injecting cocaine, injecting heroin, speedballs you refer to, which was a mix of cocaine and heroin. And you say you even got to the point where you were injecting cocaine 40 times a day.
It's
amazing.
Some people were saying, oh, how could you possibly do that? Those people have never lived with a cocaine dealer. That's how you can possibly do that. If it's there, you can continue to do more, even when you know that more is going to be horrible. And at the very end of my addiction, I would just wake up in the morning and I'd be like, I'm not going to shoot coke today. I will not shoot any coke today. This will be bad because I'm on methadone and it will just make everything worse. And then, of course, you know, at the time I was up for a few hours, I would, of course, I'll just do one. And then I'd be off to the races, and then I'd have to get heroin to bring me down from the coke. And then I'd have to go to the methadone program, and I'd be so dehydrated, I couldn't give a urine sample. And it was just horrible. And I knew that something messed up was going on, but I was really afraid to seek help because I knew that so much of the help that existed was humiliating and degrading. And, you know, I'd sort of gotten to addiction to avoid being humiliated and bullied.
That's really fascinating. And so, you know, to hear that description and the way that you go into it in the book, because not only are you doing all of that, but it looks like like a drug pad with, you know, the room is all messed up. There are needles everywhere, clothes everywhere. Nothing's being taken care of during this, the real low point. And yet you say that the idea of needing to hit bottom is kind of a myth, because one would think that that would be, have been the bottom for you.
Yeah, and I mean, the thing, the problem with the idea of bottom is that it is basically a tale of sin and redemption, and it can only be determined retrospectively. So, like, let's say I had that horrible experience in that room and I'm shooting up and whatever, and then I go to treatment, that's my bottom, and then 6 months later I relapse. So now I have a new bottom. It's a bottom with a trap door. It's just ridiculous. Like, if the idea of bottom worked, addiction wouldn't exist, because addiction is compulsive behavior that occurs despite the negative consequences. And so if negative consequences, aka hitting bottom, were going to fix it, the problem shouldn't exist. So it's a very ridiculous way of seeing things, and it, you know, it makes a great story if you tell it as though this moment was the bottom. And I certainly had an insight that in my case helped me get into recovery, but there are plenty of other people that just slowly crawl out and relapse and crawl out and relapse and come further and come further and eventually stop in a very boring way that is nowhere near a bottom. So it is, it's just, you know, we have to not be held hostage to these narratives that our culture wants to place on this.
Yeah. And as you recount in the book, there are several places that might have been considered a bottom. Beyond that, you were a student at Columbia, and you got dropped from Columbia, and then you got busted as a dealer, which was huge. I may have missed it. I don't recall. How did you? I think you succeeded in avoiding prison, right?
Yeah, and I mean that was absolute miracle, and was, you know, a lot of that had to do with being white and female. And, you know, I'm not saying that to be like saying that the particular judge in question was racist. I don't think she was consciously racist. I just think that the system is racist because our drug laws were created as ways of attacking groups of people that we wanted to suppress. And if you look at the history of the drug laws, it's very clear that that is absolutely the case. Because I was white and went to an Ivy League school, I was able to demonstrate that I could recover. And so when I chose to go into treatment at a certain point, it was about a year and a half after I got arrested, something like that. And I knew I needed help, and I went to court and I said, I'm getting into treatment. And, you know, the judge later said that she would have locked me up for my own good if I hadn't chosen to get help at that time. But I did choose to get help at that time, so that was threat was never mentioned. And anyway, I then came back to court 4 months later, and instead of being this very scary, scraggly, sick-looking person, I was tan, I was fat. I still had my hair a horrible blonde color that didn't look very good on me, but I looked like I had life in my eyes again. And she didn't see recovery very often in her court. And so when she saw it, she wanted to protect it and to allow me to recover, since I was seeming to pull myself out of that life. But the reason I was able to do that is my parents had insurance, and I had, you know, I was always a good student. I was able to do this stuff at the time that it was required for me to do it, you know, in part by luck. And so this is, I mean, I just think our drug laws, their origins show that they were not made by science or for anything to do with public health. They continue to be racist in terms of their enforcement. And they just don't work. They just don't take into account what addiction actually is.
Okay, so you were an addict for, what, 3 or 4 years, would you say?
Yes. I mean, yeah.
And now for at least 30 years or more, you have not been an addict. And what do you credit for that? What is the word cure allowed?
I mean, I look at it like this. I think there was clearly partially a maturation thing going on there, because when I was finally able to get into recovery, I was 23. I was at the point of life when, you know, that cortex is finally giving you the self-control to be able to start to deal with the problem. So there was that. There was also, I was clearly convinced that I could not go on the way it was going on and that the drugs were not working. And so I realized that, you know, this thing, these substances that I thought were saving me were actually harming me. And so I was able to, you know, I knew I had to stop. I got social support from 12-step programs, which was very important in the beginning. As you know from reading the book, there are some issues I have with 12-step programs, yeah. But I think that the, you know, the idea of having a group of peers that supports you, that you can call, that offers tips about dealing with things that might make you relapse, that offers a social life, this is a very, very good thing, and most people need that in order to recover. Does it have to be a 12-step group? I think that answer is no. But are 12-step groups the one thing that is available 24/7 in most communities? The answer to that is yes. So, you know, I had 30 days in a rehab. I had my family supporting me, which was really crucial. I went back to school, which also helped a lot. And I also discovered that I suffered from depression. And when I got that treated, my life improved dramatically. Medication has been huge for me in terms of depression. And the sensory issues that I continue to have are mitigated to some extent, at least, by the antidepressants. And other people who are on the autism spectrum have reported this as well.
Yeah, interesting. You've got a chapter on neurodiversity, and you place yourself on the autism spectrum. So, and just the term neurodiversity reflects a whole new look and consideration about autism and ADHD and such. So, tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. So, the idea of neurodiversity is that human beings are wired in a wildly varying number of ways. And some of these ways give both advantages and disadvantages. So, for example, with ADHD, certainly it can impair your concentration and make certain lines of work very difficult. On the other hand, it can make other kinds of work extraordinarily easy. This is why a lot of people with ADHD are successful in fields like policing and emergency work, and also as entrepreneurs, where they can follow the things that they're passionate about. Because one of the weird things about ADHD is that you have a very hard time concentrating on something you're not interested in. But if you're interested in something, you have really intense focus. And that, of course, looks to parents like you're willfully choosing, like, this I can do and I'm refusing to do the other thing. But it's actually not the case. And it's very frustrating, both for the child and the parent. But anyway, in terms of neurodiversity, so ADHD gives some disadvantages and some advantages. And similarly with autistic spectrum conditions, you know, the oversensitivity and the social difficulties are obviously problematic. And certainly there are some people on the spectrum who are severely disabled by it. Then there are also cases where if you can mitigate that stuff, people have extraordinary talents. And we've seen that in things like, you know, computer programming and music and art and all kinds of different things.
I think we see it in you in this book because of you had to have incredible focus, I think, to write this book.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, my attention issues have always been sort of more of like overly compulsive focus rather than distraction. And so it's like sort of, I get stuck on things, but, you know, when I'm on them, I'm really good. But right. So that's like, you know, and I mean, that's really the story with addiction too. Like, it's like when I devoted this obsessive energy to addiction, it was extraordinarily destructive. But when I can use this focus to help other people with addiction or to help explain addiction, then it can be productive and useful. And I don't have to hate myself.
Yeah. Now, what about methadone? You're you're critical of the way that methadone is used, I believe. And I think methadone is frequently used. So what's your take on that?
I think, and I mean, the data is very, very clear on this. If you want to reduce the death, the only thing that we know that cuts mortality in people with opioid addiction by 50% or more is long-term maintenance with either methadone or buprenorphine, which is the brand name, has the brand name of Suboxone. So I am very much in favor of long-term maintenance for people who want it, and for people who are just using it as sheer harm reduction, because even if you continue using on top, you are at lower risk of dying. And if you're alive, you can eventually recover. So I had a bad experience personally with methadone because I was in a program that detoxed me way too fast, that did not provide especially helpful social support. And that was, you know, it was sort of typical of the bad treatment that was available in the 1980s. Unfortunately, there's still a lot of that around. But I am very much in favor of expanding access to methadone and buprenorphine as much as possible so that we can keep people alive long enough to either stabilize on those drugs and stay on them just like me on Prozac, or they can eventually taper off. But that, I don't care what drug is in your system. I care about whether you are happy and productive.
Right, right. Now, you mentioned harm reduction, and you've got a chapter on harm reduction. So bring us up to speed on that.
Sure. I mean, that's actually what I was just talking about with maintenance. There's sort of two things that can go on in maintenance. One thing is you stop taking other drugs, you know, work on getting your life back, maybe you have some counseling, maybe you need some mental health care, like dealing with depression or other things like this, but you are not using anything other than your prescribed medication, and you are as much in recovery as I am. The other form of maintenance, you are simply getting a daily dose of either methadone or buprenorphine. You may be using on top. You aren't, you aren't working to get your life together. You're still pretty much in active addiction. But you are in touch with healthcare resources because you have to be in order to get your medication. And you are at reduced risk of dying of overdose because in the case of buprenorphine, some receptor actions, and in the case of both of them at any dose, it just builds your tolerance. And the more tolerance you have, the less likely you are to be able to afford to die of an overdose, which means you are unlikely to die of an overdose. So that is harm reduction. And the idea of harm reduction is that addiction is complicated. A lot of people with addiction are severely traumatized, so much so that they can't give up the thing that allows them, or that they believe that allows them to cope, until they have built in other coping skills. So harm reduction meets people where they're at. If they want to simply reduce using, if they want to just use clean needles, if they want to go to a safe injection space, these things allow people to get contact with services even if they don't feel like they can successfully maintain abstinence. And when you do that, what you find is really quite amazing, because when people are just treated with respect, and when you basically give a clean needle or you allow someone to inject in a safe space, you say, "I think you deserve to live," regardless of whether I'm judging your drug use or regardless of whether society is judging you like that, I think your life is valuable. And sometimes when you have become so beaten down that you think you're not valuable anymore, and you are told constantly that you're a piece of garbage, when somebody values you, it can bring you on the path towards valuing yourself again. And that is why harm reduction has been such a success throughout the world in many areas. I mean, New York State, after resisting needle exchange for a very long time, our state health department now calls it the one thing that can be called the gold standard for HIV prevention. Notice that that is not condoms. And, you know, people thought that it would be the opposite, like, oh, IV drug users won't use clean needles and, you know, it'll be easier to get, you know, men to use condoms. That is not the case.
Now, what about decriminalization? It sounds like that's almost a, is that a precondition for harm reduction on a large scale?
It's certainly an important part of harm reduction because criminalization helps no one and does lots of harm. So if you realize that addiction is compulsive behavior despite negative consequences, using the criminal justice system to create negative consequences is not going to be an effective use of your resources. If instead you don't arrest people for possession and you allow people to use that money instead to pay for services that are user-friendly, that attract people into getting help, and that reduce the harm while they're actively using, and that help them get into many forms of recovery. So I think, you know, that's decriminalization really. Also, if we're going to say that addiction is a medical disorder, call it a disease, call it a learning disorder, just call it a medical health issue, we don't treat any medical issue with criminal justice. We just don't. So it is impossible to destigmatize something at the same time as you are criminalizing it, because the whole point of criminalizing something is to stigmatize it so that people don't do it.
Yeah. What country is sort of the gold standard in terms of doing it the right way?
Well, I mean, Portugal has completely decriminalized possession, including things like heroin and cocaine. And they have seen a drop in overdose deaths, a drop in addiction to IV drugs, and generally very positive consequences all around. I tend to think we should absolutely go further than that with marijuana and legalize it, including sales. I think that once we figure out systems for doing that, then we can look at the other substances, because the problem with having a multi-billion or probably trillion-dollar illegal market of drugs is that you have no controls over quality and you have no controls over marketing, and you also have gangsters getting huge amounts of money and corrupting people up and down the chain. And I think decriminalization will do a lot to help the people with addiction. But if you continue to have sales criminalized, you will continue to have users having an incentive to sell to each other in order to support their habits. And you will have, you know, sort of an ongoing over-criminalization problem, as well as gangsters.
Yeah, I'm going back to remembering when you talked about the maturation of your brain and you felt that that really had something to do with it. And there's a lot in the book about the adolescent brain and, you know, how those controls aren't there. And there's an impulsivity and there's an inability to consider the long-term future and all of that. And your own experience was that as that frontal cortex matured to the point today, when you wrote this book, you said it was difficult for you to write out your story because you looked on it with horror. Things that you were so readily willing to do as an adolescent, you now look back on and you're just kind of horrified, and I can relate to that myself.
Yeah, it's really, I think a lot of people who had, you know, crazy experiences during their teen years, especially when they become parents, but even if they don't, when you get to a certain age, your brain has just matured so much that it's very hard to understand the logic that, or the lack of logic, that led you to that kind of behavior. One of the things that I've always been motivated by my whole life is I'm completely terrified of death, and yet I was like shooting heroin and cocaine. So how does that even work?
Right. Yeah, a contradiction that your adult brain recognizes, but your adolescent one didn't. Let's go into the brain a little bit more deeply. You've got a chapter on dopamine that emphasizes the complexity of its effects on the brain. We associate dopamine with driving pleasure, but as you point out, not always. So there's some real interesting things about dopamine.
Yes, it's interesting. I'm actually reporting a story on dopamine now for Science of the American Mind, and one of the things that I will probably need to update in future editions of the book is the guy, Roy Wise, who is behind the theory that dopamine equals pleasure, actually no longer supports his own theory. But so what people agree on very little about dopamine, but they all seem to agree now that it is not pleasure. It may be desire, and it may have an element of the pleasure of what I mentioned in the book called the pleasure of the hunt, as opposed to the pleasure of the feast. And the pleasure of the hunt is when you are, you know, seeking something, you are desirous of it, you think you can get it, you feel confident, and you are, you know, just stalking your prey. And obviously the pleasure of the feast is the satiation, you've got it, you're enjoying it, all is good. You're not in that escalated state of desire anymore. So what dopamine seems to be involved in, at least in some parts of the brain, is driving the desire. And when desire is pleasurable, there can be pleasure in it. But if you have unsatiated desire, that is definitely not pleasurable. So, you know, it gets very complicated. But dopamine does seem to be involved in that motivation, the desire, the goal setting, the way your brain prioritizes things, the way it sets values on things. It also seems to be involved in something called reward prediction error, where essentially what it's doing is saying, okay, you know, if there is an association between A and B, if A happens, then B happens. And if B is a good thing, the dopamine is going to spike when A happens because you're now expecting B. And if B doesn't turn out to show up, then you're disappointed. And that's really awful. And your dopamine is actually lower than normal. So it's kind of, it's predicting, you know, your expectations. Is this going to be as good as expected? Is it going to be worse than expected? Is it going to be better than expected? And you always are unconsciously making these expectation judgments. And I think disappointment has always been an emotion that is awful for people with addiction, and it often leads to relapse. And I wonder if it has to do with the fact that basically disappointment is a reward prediction error. You thought something good was going to happen, and it didn't, or maybe something bad happened instead. So it's, I think it's really quite interesting, and you know, we really don't understand as much. I think this happens in science in general. You sort of think you got something, and then some new experiment complicates it, and you find out that you knew less than you did in the first place, but you're getting more details.
Yeah, and probably relevant to what you're saying now is you talk about the dynamics of sensitization and habituation, such that you find yourself wanting to shoot cocaine even as you were liking it less and less.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. And this is the idea of what they call incentive salience. This basically means that liking and wanting are two different things. And it is definitely the case, I can tell you this from my personal experience, that you can desperately want something that you do not like anymore. And that is a horrible experience because, like, you find yourself shooting coke and knowing it's going to suck and knowing that it's going to feel awful and it's going to make you really anxious and not feel good at all, and yet be unable to stop yourself from doing it. I think a lot of people can relate to this in relationships,
right,
where people end up sort of desperately wanting somebody they don't like much anymore. And I think probably all of us have had at least one experience of that, and it is, you know, very confounding.
It was interesting that you talked about set and setting, which most of us know is emphasized a lot in relation to psychedelics, the importance of set and setting so that you don't have, quotes, a bad trip. I had not heard that concept applied to other drugs like heroin and cocaine.
Yeah, I mean, that's the it applies to every substance. I mean, even things like antidepressants, weirdly enough. But it's, yeah, I mean, when you take a drug in a dangerous setting or in a new setting, it can have a very different result than what you are typically used to. And this often happens with alcohol, where people find themselves getting way drunker than they expected because they're drinking in a new situation with new people and their tolerance doesn't kick in the way it would in a familiar setting. Because bizarrely enough, tolerance is basically conditioned to some extent. So you learn that when this cue happens, the drug is about to come and your system compensates. But if you don't get that cue, you can actually die of an overdose of your same normal dose if you do it in a different setting. So these concepts are really important, and we really need to be studying this more with the opioid epidemic, because a lot of the unexplained overdoses may be related to this, and we may be able to do things that could reduce that risk.
Yeah, fascinating. Now, going back to the subtitle of your book, you know, it describes this developmental and learning approach as new and revolutionary. But somewhere else you kind of mention that it's really not new information. So, well, what's going on with that?
Well, I mean, marketing is what's going on with that. You know, and I mean, I think what's weird about that. So let me say what this situation is there. So first of all, scientists have known that addiction is a learning problem from the get-go. This is why virtually all addiction experiments in animals involve very basic Skinner boxes and, you know, pressing a lever to get a reward and lights cueing things. It's very basic behavioral stuff. And so this has been known in the research world forever. It's just not emphasized to the public. So the public hears from neuroscientists, disease, 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 disease. They don't hear about what's actually going on in the brain in terms of, you know, they might hear like nucleus accumbens or something, and they might hear hijacked. But the reality is more complicated. The reality is that you can't be addicted if you don't learn that the drug fixes some kind of problem for you. And this is why it drives me crazy when people say babies can be born addicted to something. A baby can't be born addicted to something because it doesn't know what to crave. It doesn't know it's craving heroin as opposed to craving mommy. And so it cannot go out and use a drug despite negative consequences, because a baby can't go out and get drugs by itself. So it is a very, again, this is the problem of confusing physical dependence and addiction. Now I've lost where I'm going with that.
Well, I'm not sure where you were going either. our time is about up here, I think. So I wonder if there's, as we wind down, if there's anything else you'd like to add.
No, I mean, I think the important thing in understanding addiction is that because addiction is learning in the areas of the brain that generally teach you to love and to parent, and that teach you to do all your persistence to take care of the people you love, when we're trying to help people recover from addiction, love is crucial. Love, social support, affection, friendship, these things help people get better. What does not help people get better is shame, humiliation, punishment, attacks. These things actually make people worse. And when we understand what's going wrong in addiction, we can have a much more compassionate and actually much more effective way of dealing with it.
Well, that's a great wrap-up, and I really admire the work that you're doing. And Maya Solovitz, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
And thank you so much for a fascinating conversation.
Unfortunately, we had a number of technical difficulties during this interview. I had hoped to record video of the entire interview, but Skype was giving us problems. Fortunately, I was able to get enough video to create a video preview of the interview. There were also audio challenges, not the least of which was construction noise going on outside Maya's window. So I hope the audio was sufficiently intelligible for you to enjoy this important interview. I really appreciate Maya's work and the opportunity to speak with her, as well as her courage in being so candid about her personal experiences with addiction to hard drugs. As we noted in the interview, reviewing those episodes from her youth are painful now to her adult brain. I can't begin to tell you how impressed I am by Maya's book, Unbroken Brain. She does such a seamless job of integrating the harrowing story of her own addiction with all the latest deep science relating to addiction. And it's such a wide net she casts covering research relating to adolescent development, brain structures, the dopamine system and other neurotransmitters, self-esteem, the chemistry of romance, racism and classism, self-esteem, dominance, learning theory, the role of set and setting, the myth of the addictive personality, harm reduction, and more. I found myself doing so much underlining that there's hardly a page that's untouched. I would say this is a must-have book, not only for anyone working in the addiction field, but also for all therapists and counselors and teachers, as well as any other roles that come into contact with adolescents, and certainly for anyone struggling with addiction themselves. As always, you can use our Amazon.com affiliate widget in the right-hand sidebar at shrinkwrapradio.com to order Unbroken Brain, A Revolutionary New Way of Understanding Addiction by Maya Solovitz. By doing so, you'll also be making a small donation to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hi, Dr. Dave. I wanted to thank you for the remarkable podcast series that you've put together. I've been listening for many months now as I run, and I'm like a kid in a candy store. This is really a remarkable reservoir of information. I do have a check off to you, and I encourage everyone to think about how just valuable your service is. The book review aspect alone is incredible. It's really allowed me to focus on what I'd really like to read and buy and to glean the essentials of something that I might have interest in but perhaps not adequate time. As I mentioned, I'm a long-distance runner, and so I listen to you a lot. I find your podcast educational, entertainment, and kind of a secondhand therapy. One of the things I've learned from your podcast is that exercise is as good as meditation, so I guess I get a dose every time I go for a run. All kidding aside, it's just remarkable. It's a valuable service and a real gift. So I ask everyone to look into their heart, look at their watch and the time that you save them, and look in their wallet and make a contribution so that you can continue doing this good work. Thank you so much. As a full spectrum listener, I really appreciate it. God bless.
Thank you, full spectrum listener Jan Prynne. Hopefully others consider Shrink Wrap as exceptional as you do. Although you recorded this some time back, I know you're still out there listening because I read an email from you on last week's podcast. If you are not already a financial supporter, I hope you'll join Jan as a donor. I'm happy to announce that we do have a couple of new donors since the last episode. Big thanks go out to Xiaoting Joyce and Terry Keller. Thank you both. As I mentioned at the beginning, we do have a new sponsor, Bombas Socks. I've been an ongoing customer of theirs for several years. Why? Because of the bright colors and distinctive patterns, the fact that they provide socks for both men and women and in various lengths, including little shorties that are great for summer tennis. Also, I appreciate their philanthropic commitment to provide a pair of socks to a homeless person for every pair you order. If you're a listener in the U.S., you can save 20% off your first order by going to getbombas.com/shrinkwrapradio. And Bombas is spelled B-O-M-B-A-S. If you're a user of our Shrink Wrap Radio app, you may have noticed that I've been able to start putting up short video previews a day or so before the next interview. I hope you are enjoying and appreciating that work on my part. If you don't have our app, it is available for all smartphones. Just go to the Apps tab at Shrink Wrap Radio for full information. And remember, you can find both the video preview and, when it's available, the full video of the interview on my YouTube channel at youtube.com/shrinkwrapradio. And speaking of getting notified of the next episode, you'll get that if you are subscribed to our Facebook page. Just go to facebook.com/shrinkwrapradio, all one word. We have 1,420 likes there, but we have around 7,000 listeners that I know about. So how about visiting that page and pumping up our likes? Seems like that might be important in today's world.
Hi, this is Maya Solovitz, journalist and author of the 2016 book, Unbroken Brain, A Revolutionary New Way of Understanding Addiction. And you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Now let's go to some recent emails from our listener community. First, we hear from Terry, who writes in response to my thanks for her donation. You're most welcome, and thank you for so consistently putting together such an incredible show. Your questions are incisive and pull the most interesting and useful information out of your fascinating guests, and your style and personality are incredibly charming. And that's from Terry. And Terry, thank you so much for that. Next, we hear from Zhao Ting, who writes, Dear Dr. Dave, it's truly my pleasure to support Shrink Wrap Radio. I've been a longtime listener slash fan of Shrink Wrap Radio and Wise Counsel. Boy, you have been listening a long time if you go back to Wise Counsel. I cannot tell you how much I've learned from you and the guest speakers. I'm a mental health therapist here in Santa Clara County, and your soulful podcast has expanded my knowledge and interests, especially Jungian psychology. I have recommended your podcast to my family, schoolmates, and colleagues. I've also listened to Shrink Wrap Radio with my infant. I think he's been shrink-wrapped on the bassinet. It feels good to support Shrink Wrap Radio financially. I encourage everyone to get involved in contributing to the Shrink Wrap Radio podcast community that you love and care, and keep Dr. Dave's wonderful work going. Thank you, truly. All the best. And again, that's from Shaw Ting. So I really appreciate that note of support and encouraging others to help support the show. And in that vein, finally, here's one more from naturopathic Dr. Ralph Wilson, who writes in part, David, these years that I've had Shrink Wrap Radio in my life have been ones of gradually turning the mud and grime that had covered my memories and my self-image over the span of my life into knowing how to clean up my life in much more detail. In addition, I'm beginning to activate that knowledge of how to clean up my life. I've made some astounding recoveries of skill sets and acquaintances from my past, thanks to self-applied psychotherapy techniques, and I'm now feeling much more empowered to be a contributing member of the human family. Your podcast interviews are a priceless resource, and I'm glad for having signed up to make monthly automatic payments. The amount that I offer to your coffer monthly is not the traditional tenth of what comes in, which is called a tithe in many religions as a sign of commitment. No, the glimmer of flashing coins tossed your way could be thought of as a sharing of sunlight beams bouncing off the shiny coins and sparking memories for you and me of the brilliance of the humans who are the substance of your career teaching humanistic psychology. I wholeheartedly support your current next career as founder and CEO of Shrink Wrap Radio. Thanks for helping me to more proudly play and build my ease and gracefulness in life. And that, again, is from naturopathic Dr. Ralph Wilson, who is also a diplomate in acupuncture. And I have to say I'm really impressed by the use he's made of the information in these podcasts to better understand himself and to move past personal traumas in his history. I hope his sharing here will help others to do likewise. So once again, I think that better wrap it up for today. As always, you can send emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. In addition, you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site, and you can leave voicemail using our app or our message phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks to today's guest, Maya Solovitz, for sharing so intimately her own journey and helping us to better understand the complexities of addiction. My next interview will be with UC Berkeley professor Dacher Keltner, whom I interviewed back in 2009 on health and happiness. I have to say he's one of my intellectual heroes, and we'll be discussing his 2016 book, The Power Paradox, How We Gain and Lose Influence. Be sure to stay tuned for our customized shrink wrap radio version of Key to the Highway, performed by a listener some years back. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
Been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.